now, the new adventures of Matt Hancock.
That thin pink tie is very nasty. Where have I seen that before?
I mean, possibly on the television.
Oh, you were on television, were you? I had no idea. So then, welcome, Mr. Hanky.
Hancock.
Hankycock. Today, we're going to assess your eligibility for Job Seekers Allowance. Can I ask your reasons for leaving your previous employment?
Well, I was sort of fired for having an affair, really.
Oh, of course, if you were fired from a job, this leaves you unable to claim JSA for 6 weeks.
Yes, but this was last year.
I see. I'm just looking over your CV, Mr. Hankycock. Under skills, you've put loyalty in the face of the indefensible and getting the big calls right.
That's right, yes.
I mean, are you proficient with Microsoft Office? You know, Word, Excel, Outlook and so on?
No, I tended to get all my important communications on hard copy delivered to me in red velvet briefcases. Is that not standard?
It's not hugely standard, in point of fact, Mr. Cockhanky. No, do you have a clean driving licence?
I do.
How do you feel about chemicals?
Well, in America, the Koch brothers have really got the industrial chemical market sewn up, haven't they? I suppose in Britain, with our world-beating regulations in place, there must be rather more scope to free up the market and run a more entrepreneurial operation. This would be a CEO or a board-level position, of course.
Greg's in the high street, need a cleaner. 2 hours each morning, $12.50 an hour.
$12.50 an hour? My agent suggested a fee of £10,000 a day would be more suitable remuneration for a man in my position.
The position of a middle-aged white man with a nasty pink tie and no chin, who ham-fistedly bungled his way through the biggest public health crisis in a century, with nothing but a moribund NHS and a mistress on his own payroll.
Well, yes.
Otherwise, there's a vacancy at the West Suffolk Chronicle.
Yes, editorship of a large newspaper would be more my thing.
For a part-time photocopier technician.
I mean, I don't even know what that is.
You stand by the photocopier all day. If it breaks down, you unjam the paper, change the toner cartridge, then kick the frightful thing until it starts working again.
That's not really my thing.
Would you be willing to relocate?
Oh, possibly. Why?
Highways England need volunteers to work as traffic cones alongside a stretch of the M11.
Don't we have any actual plastic traffic cones anymore?
No. We used to import them. From Europe.
So, what I'm hearing is that you don't really have any jobs for me.
Not as of today, no, but who knows? One might come along. I'll get you entered into the system. Once you get on your knees and wank off this turkey.
I beg your pardon?
Wank off this turkey. Wank it off. Use both hands, you pusillanimous little penile membrane. You M&S-suited sack of soft-serve chicken shit. You cod-faced, quivering little custard-panted colon. Cog the turkey's truncheon.
I will not, sir. I will not. For months now, I've faced nothing but demeaning requests to perform all manner of bestial misdeeds and eat animal parts that would make your eyes water, and I am sick of it. Whatever you think you can get away with because I went on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, you are 100% wrong. Now remove this tumescent fowl from my sight.
I'm a Celebrity? I don't give a shit what reality TV you've done. But under recent changes to the legislation implemented by the Department of Work and Pensions, if you don't wank this turkey, crawl over broken glass with your flies undone and then wait 12 weeks with no means of supporting yourself, you can kiss goodbye to qualifying for job seekers, Mr. Turdcock.
Well, thank heavens I'm still getting my salary as a Member of Parliament. Without that 80k, I'd struggle with the basic costs of living.
Streets like a jungle. So call the police. following the herd down to Greece on holiday, love in the 90s. It's paranoid on sunny beaches. Take your chances looking for girls who are boys who like boys to be girls who like boys like girls who do girls like their boys. Always be someone you really love.
Tonight on Was He Though? We put another deviant criminal under the microscope, look at the facts, and consider the evidence that led to their arrest, downfall, and criminal notoriety that shall ring evermore unto eternity. With me this week is Professor Gordon Baudelaire, former inspector of the CID and now head of the Unspeakable Deeds MA course at the University of East Anglia. We're looking this week at the roaring monster and children's entertainer, Rolf Harris. Good evening, Professor.
Good evening.
It's alleged that back in the 1980s, during those rare moments when he wasn't tiresomely scribbling his trademark human-kangaroo hybrids all afternoon on BBC One, Australian artist Sir Rolf Harris was an out-of-control, unstoppable, unrelenting kiddly-diddler, whose acts were so heinous that the sentencing judge observed that to Harris, who had covered the song in the early 90s, the stairway to heaven was probably the stairway leading to an underfunded creche with notoriously lax security. They say he was a dreadful force for evil, a nonce, a pedo. My question to you, Professor Baudelaire, is simply this. Was he, though?
Oh, I should think so, yes. Most definitely.
Thank you, Professor Baudelaire. Your fee's in the post.
Can you tell me what it is yet?
Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the early 20s, fancied itself a bustling metropolis, flirting with the idea of joining the jazz age, but still clinging to its parochial love of the prairie song. As a doctor of some experience, I knew summer in Tulsa could be a darn busy time, and I would be damn near run off my pegs with cases to examine. It was mostly due to the fact Tulsa was often host to a number of traveling fairs and carnivals. They swept through the great plains like twisters and tornadoes, some might say wreaking nearly as much havoc. Yes, sirree, I was sure a shinola of regular work when the fair was in town. Oh boy. Amongst the carny folk, the animal wranglers would need their wounds attending. The circus strongman would inevitably prolapse his own anus due to the demands of his trade. Bearded ladies suffered brutal attacks on their persons for confusing the simple local menfolk. Clowns and the little people would doubtless suffer injuries due to their being infernal creatures of immorality and disrepute. But needless to say, the town's denizens would also be adversely affected by the fair's presence. Seemingly every young gallant would present a weeping, bepustuled member upon my desk within a week of the carnival coming through town. Social diseases were rife, and antibiotics had not yet fully made their way to our Midwestern enclave. In such cases, I would take to fully bathing my patients in a tub of mercury. Well, but this was all meat and potatoes to a simple general practitioner like myself. But one case came to me that I can never truly shake free. And despite my manifest wisdom and experience, I've still not made sense of it all these years later. The family Hiscox Circus rolled into town one bright July 4th morning, the self-proclaimed greatest show west of the Mississippi. A few days later, Jeremiah J. Hiscox himself, together with his good lady wife, pulled up to my humble practice in his elegant Packard Twin Six. He lifted his wife out from the carriage and escorted her gently in, watchful over his environs, clearly anxious for some anonymity. Indeed, she wore a large-brimmed hat with veil upon her tiny head, protecting her modesty from the prying eyes of peeping Toms. No sooner had my door closed than he launched into his earnest and heartfelt diatribe.
"I want a son, Chitterlings, a son, an heir to my fortune. You must examine my wife. She is to give me my heart's desire, but thusly far has failed in her God-given task."
I professed not to be of the gynecological persuasion, but the process of procreation, I explained, is part miracle, part mechanical. Are you sure you have the right hole, sir?
"Do you take me for a fool, Chitterlings, bless your eyes? I know my way around a female, and in what furrow to sow my seed. But she and her infernal womb have foiled my designs. I want a child. Male, preferably, but I'll accept any of the others."
And during all of this, Mrs. Hiscox sat silent, demurring in her pretty little dress, her begloved hand still clinging lovingly to her husband's coattails. I agreed to examine the poor barren wretch, but suggested we should have a privacy, a doctor-patient confidentiality, if you will, and that he should leave the room. Hiscox fumed and denied the request, lest I should be overcome with desire for his good lady wife and attempt to implant my own seed. I did not have the stomach for a fight, so hesitantly began my examination, trussing the woman up into stirrups for ease of entry. Thankfully, she was obliging, and any nervousness seemed to be abated when he handed her a tinned fruit salad to enjoy. I know the Hiscox is to be long dead, and so my indiscretion, sharing what I'm about to tell you, is perhaps more forgivable now, shrouded as it is in the mists of time. My initial findings were unusual. She seemed uncommonly hirsute. Thick black hair covered not only her nethers, but her short thighs and calves. Her dainty kitten-heeled shoe had fallen off, and her foot wrapped itself dexterously around the chair leg. And perhaps most worryingly, she seemed to have only four toes. Now, I had spent some time at a practice in the Appalachians a decade or so before, and such abnormalities were not unknown to me. But this was all remarkably irregular. I couldn't quite put my finger on it. Yet whilst my finger was on it, I noted the lack of a clitoris, a detail that seemed unimportant given the nature of the complaint, but everything else appeared rudimentarily in place, give or take the odd peanut inexplicably found up there. As I said, I was only a general practitioner, not a so-called pudenda specialist. All the while this was happening, she seemed content to just eat grapes, and then started to examine my scalp diligently with her long fingers, as if probing for ticks.
"Well, Doc, is she viable?"
asked Jeremiah J. as I finished up and washed my hands. Oh, I desperately searched for the right thing to say to assuage his worries, even though I knew I was out of my depth. "I believe her to be intact, Mr. Hiscox, but only God can now give you what you desire. Have faith, and you'll surely be blessed with child when God wills it so.
Ah, horseshit, he said. I don't think he'll be assisting us anytime soon.
He brusquely picked up his wife and made his way back to the car. Once there, she leapt from his arms and clambered onto the rear of the old Packard with alarming celerity, proceeded to lift the spare tire from its rack and spin upon it like a dervish in the sand. She howled something loud but indistinct, and that's when it struck me. The poor creature was half crazy, clearly driven mad by her own lack of fecundity. He shouted at her,
"Not now, Elaine, or you'll be in the cage tonight."
Poor, sweet, unusually long-armed woman. What a life she must have led. I wish I could have helped her more, but her ailments were beyond my medical expertise. At least she was laughing as they sped off down the track, he paying for my services by throwing dollar bills to the wind. I got out of Tulsa before the Dust Bowl hit in 34, and I headed to the coast and to more uncanny cases than you can possibly imagine. So listen up to the next installment of The Curious Cabinet of Dr. Earl K. Chitterlings. So long for now, folks.
Next on Cake or Not, our panel have to decide which is the cake and which is the real Jacob Rees-Mogg.
So without further ado, please reveal our two Jacobs.
Oh man.
Oh my God.
I know,
oh God,
right?
This is crazy.
How'd you get the chalk stripes so real?
So Jacob Rees-Mogg is 53 from Hammersmith in London. He's the chair for the European Research Group and MP for North East Somerset. But which one is which? You have only 10 seconds left, panel, to make your decision. Is it cake, or is it really the former Minister of State for Brexit Opportunities and Government Efficiency?
Oh, man.
I know.
Oh, my day.
Can you, like, get him to speak all posh?
Yeah, no, afraid not. That would give the game away rather, eh? Besides, he's unconscious. So, your time is up.
Which one are you going to cut?
We should definitely go for, like, number one.
Oh, definitely got to choose number one.
I have not got a Scooby.
Yeah,
we'll go number one.
Yes, number one.
All right, you've chosen number one. So, take the knife and let's put this thing to rest. Slice him open just above the glasses. And it was... cake!
Oh, that's fantastic!
No way, I would have thought that was in my head. We didn't manage to fool our panel. It's incredible! Great effort by our show bakers, though, eh? And next up, after the break,
we go up a notch. Is it cake or is it Poland?
That's coming up on Cake or Not.
Hi there, I'm Fintan Hullabaloo, and welcome to Christ's Kitchen. Coming up, the Reverend Kenneth Terrapin will be here to serve you up some tasty theological crudités. Food, if you will, for thought. But first, here in the high-pressure kitchens 1 mile beneath Durham Cathedral, we'll be cooking up a storm for the bishop and a conclave of visiting ecclesiastical dignitaries from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, most people associate the Son of Man, Jesus Christ, with simple fare like some loaves of bread and a few broiled sprats. But this week, we're knocking up something more elaborate. From page 72 of the Bible, poached pheasant with a cranberry roulade, which of course St. Paul created as an offering to those heathenish Corinthians. And we start with a freshly shaved bird. Look at these meaty thighs. And the very first thing we're going to do is get two fingers up her. To insert half a lemon. Once you've filled her up, things should feel nice and tight up there. Roll her over and give her a thorough basting. Some people like to gently and evenly apply it, but after a quick but thorough stuffing, I prefer to just squirt two or three arcs of my fat all over her back. That's what St. Paul surely did. Then you take a firm grip of your rolling pin, taking care to wrap both hands around your shaft, and just roughly slap it around your bird's breasts until you're satisfied. Now, there are those silly doubters out there who scoff at the very idea of Jesus preparing game for his platonic friend Mary Magdalene's roast supper, but I remain convinced that the Son of God was giving her one as often as he possibly could. 2 hours at gas mark 6, and just look at the results. Firm meat, you just can't help but wrap your lips around. I just love it when my mouth is full of meat and the juices are oozing down my chin. Which reminds me, let's go over now to the very, very Reverend Kenneth Terrapin.
And just a quick glance at tomorrow's headlines.
My eyes! Oh, it's terrible! Oh, God! Oh, don't look! Just don't look!
The Electric Sodcast was written and performed by James Burton and Ian Martin, with Harry Whitley as Bob Dylan. Our original music is composed by a 9-year-old. Catering this week was by our friends the Wu-Tang Clan.
Do you miss them, pal?